Tell me what you know about it, Razbok says. Woman was speeding, ran a red light, swerved to avoid a car, lost control, and went into a pole, Curtin says. Did she survive? Yes, Fleming says, leaning closer over his desk. She survived, but apparently she has amnesia. You're kidding me, right? Razbok says. Nope. Everyone's buying it. The doctor, the husband, Fleming says. But not you. I don't know. The husband called 911, reporting her missing the same night. She'd left the house in a hurry without her purse and her phone, forgot to lock the door. Razbok turns to Officer Curtin, who is shaking his head. I think she's lying, Curtin says. What do you know about this woman? Razbok asks. Her name is Karen Krupp, Fleming tells him. She's just a regular housewife, if you ignore where she was and what she was doing that night. A housewife? Yep. Early 30s, works as a bookkeeper. Married to an accountant. No kids. Nice home in the suburbs, Henry Park. Razbok suddenly remembers the pink rubber gloves he picked up and had bagged near the murder scene. They'd been run over, and there were tire tracks on them. What happened to the car? He asks now.
A Honda Civic. It was totaled, Curtin offers.
I'm going to need to see the tires on that car, Razbok says. He feels a little hum of excitement. Wouldn't it be interesting, he thinks, to find a connection between that car, that housewife, and his murder victim?
I guess you'll be taking it from here then, Razbok, Fleming says.
Tom is tense and unhappy as he leaves the house the next morning. He's put on jeans to go into the office for a few hours to catch up on work on the weekend. He's missed so much with Karen in the hospital. She seemed tired this morning. She was already up again when he woke. Her face, when he kissed her, was pale. The swelling on her face is gone, and the bruising has begun to fade. But she doesn't look like the old Karen. She's been different since she came home. She used to be so warm and uncomplicated. Now she's a bit distant. She's too quiet. Sometimes, if he reaches for her, she flinches. She never did that before. She seems nervous, jumpy. And he finds the episode about the glass disturbing. He's certain that no one has been in the house. Why was she so convinced that someone had? She got herself into a total panic about it. He's troubled, too. Does she really not remember that night? Or is she simply not telling him? Suspicion is an insidious thing. Doubts have started creeping in, things that he'd previously been able to ignore. Doubts about her past. When she moved in, she brought so little with her. He'd asked her at the time if she had some things in storage. She'd looked him in the eye and said, "No, this is it. I don't hang on to things. I don't like clutter." He's wondered, once or twice, why she seems to have no old ties at all. When he asked her about her family, she explained that she had no family. He understood. His parents are gone too, and he has no one left but his brother. But she has no one at all. He has friends from college, but she seems to have none. When he pressed her on it, she told him that she wasn't good at staying in touch with people. She'd acted as if he were making a big deal about nothing. He loves her. She loves him. They're perfect together. If she didn't want to tell him a lot about her life before they met, he accepted that. He's never suspected anything disturbing. He just thought she was private, not prone to sharing. But now he's not so sure he's okay with it. He realizes he doesn't really know that much about his own wife. Detectives Razbok and Jennings are at the crime lab. The lab already has the pink gloves, and they're working on them, in spite of the fact that it's a Sunday. Now Razbok offers a fragrant double espresso to Stan Price, who has agreed to come in this morning to go over the evidence with them. It's only Starbucks, But Razbok knows that Stan is usually so busy, he doesn't have time to go out.
Thanks, Stan says, his face lighting up as he takes the cup. A good coffee goes a long way.
They have a crappy little coffee maker in the basement here where the forensics lab is, but it makes famously lousy coffee. It could be because nobody ever cleans it, but nobody has been willing to test that theory by giving it a good scrub.
Razbok now makes a mental note to get a new espresso maker for the forensics department for Christmas this year.
What have you got? Razbok asks.
Well, the gloves. I was able to lift a good tire print off one of them.
Stan sips his coffee appreciatively.
The tire tracks on the glove match the make and model of the tires on the car in question. They're the right type, but we can't match them definitively to the tires you brought in. We can't say that it was definitely one of the tires on that car that drove over that glove, but it could well be.
Okay, Razbok says.
It's something.
What are the chances of getting DNA off the inside of the gloves?
I'd say pretty good, but that's going to take longer. There's a waiting list for that.
Can you speed it up for me?
Can you keep bringing me this excellent coffee?
You bet.
Karen gathers up her purse, her keys, and her cell, and prepares to leave the house. She has to run to the corner store. When she opens the front door, there's a strange man standing on the front porch. She's so startled, she almost screams. But the man standing on her doorstep, well, unexpected, doesn't appear to be threatening. He's nicely dressed in a well-cut suit. He has sandy hair and intelligent blue eyes. That's when she notices the second man, still making his way up the steps. She looks at him in dismay, and then back at the man directly in front of her.
Karen Krupp, the man says.
Yes, she answers suspiciously. Who are you?
I'm Detective Razbok.
He glances at the other man now joining him on the front porch.
And this is Detective Jennings.
Chapter 13. Karen stares at the detective, her heart pumping frantically. She hadn't been expecting this.
Can we speak to you for a few minutes? Razbok asks, pulling out his detective badge and holding it up for her to see.
She can feel her pulse in her temples. She doesn't want to speak to them. She has a lawyer now. Why hadn't he given her any advice on what to say to the cops if they came to question her again? Why hadn't she asked?
I was just on my way out, she manages to say.
This won't take long, Razbok assures her, not moving.
She hesitates, unsure of what to do. If she sends them away without speaking to them, it might antagonize them. She decides that she'd better let them in. She'll tell them that she remembers nothing. After all, it's the truth. There's nothing she can tell them about that night.
Okay, I guess a few minutes would be all right, she says, and opens the door wider, closing it behind them once they're inside.
She leads them into the living room. She sits on the sofa. They take the armchairs across from her. She fights the urge to grab one of the pillows on the sofa and hug it to her chest. Instead, she deliberately crosses her legs and leans back into the corner of the sofa, trying to appear unfazed at having two detectives in her living room. But the obvious intelligence in the detective's eyes unnerves her, and she says, a little too quickly,
I'm sure you know this already from the other police officers investigating the accident, but I don't remember anything about it.
She thinks how ridiculous that sounds. She flushes slightly.
We did hear that, yes, the detective says.
He appears relaxed, but alert. She feels like she can't put anything past this man. She's suddenly very nervous.
Actually, it isn't the accident, per se, that we're interested in.
At this, Karen feels all the blood drain from her face. She's sure they can both see it, her sudden, damning pallor.
No,
she manages to say.
No. We're investigating something else. Something that happened not far from where you had your accident. We think at around the same time.
Karen says nothing.
A man was murdered.
Murdered? She tries to keep her face neutral, but suspects she has failed miserably. What could that possibly have to do with me? She asks.
That's what we are trying to find out, Detective Rasbach says.
I don't remember anything about that night, she protests. I'm sorry, but you're probably wasting your time.
Nothing, the detective asks. He obviously doesn't believe her.
She looks at the other detective beside him. He doesn't believe her either. She shakes her head.
Maybe we can help you remember,
Rasbach says. She stares back at him, frightened. She's glad Tom isn't here. Then she wishes that he were.
We believe you were at the murder scene.
What? She feels faint.
We found a pair of rubber gloves at the scene, the other detective tells her.
She's dizzy now, and her heart is pounding. She feels herself blinking rapidly.
Are you perhaps missing a pair of pink rubber gloves? The kind you might use for washing dishes? Rasbach asks.
She lifts her head, straightens her back. No, I'm not, she says convincingly. But she knows her gloves are missing. She was looking for them yesterday. She has no idea where they've gone. She'd asked Tom, but he hadn't known either. She has the sudden courage of someone with a very strong survival instinct who is backed into a corner.
Why would you think they're mine? She asks coolly. It's quite simple, really, the detective says. The gloves were found near the murder scene, in a parking lot close by.
She says, I still don't see what that has to do with me. I never had any pink gloves.
The detective says, the gloves were run over, in that parking lot, by a car. Tire track evidence. It's almost like fingerprints. Your car has the same kind of tires as the ones that made the tracks in that parking lot. I think you ran over those gloves, in that parking lot. And then you fled, and had an accident in that car around the approximate time of the murder.
He pauses, leans forward slightly.
I think you've got a problem.
As Tom pulls into the driveway, he wonders whose car that is sitting in front of his house. A plain, newer sedan. Nobody he knows. He gets out of his own car and looks at the one in the street uneasily. Who would be visiting his wife? He hates the suspicion that he feels. Apprehensive, Tom hurries up the steps. He opens the door quickly and immediately sees two men in suits sitting in his living room. Tom, Karen says, turning her head around, clearly startled. Her expression is confusing, a mix of relief and fear. He can't tell if she's happy or horrified to see him. Maybe a bit of both.
What's going on? Tom asks to the room at large.
The two men remain silent, watching from their seats, as if waiting to see what his wife will tell him. Tom is anxious. He wonders if their insurance people hear about the accident. He doesn't need any more bad news. These two men are police detectives, Karen tells him with a slightly warning look. They're here about the other night, she says. The two men stand up in unison.
I'm Detective Rasbach, says the taller man, flashing his badge. This is Detective Jennings. Do we have to do this now? Tom says a little rudely, coming farther into the living room.
He wants his old life back.
Can't it wait? Our lawyer said he was going to put things off until she got her memory back. I'm afraid we're not here about the car accident, Detective Rasbach says.
Tom feels a sudden weakness in his legs. His heart revs sharply. He needs to sit down. He sinks onto the sofa next to Karen. He realizes that he's been waiting for something like this to happen. In his heart, he knew there was more to this story. He feels like he's opened a wrong door somewhere and ended up in some other life. One that doesn't make any sense, peopled by imposters. Tom looks guardedly at the two detectives. He glances nervously at Karen, but she isn't looking at him. When no one speaks for a moment, Detective Rasbach says,
"We were just telling your wife. We are investigating a murder that occurred not far from where she had her accident."
A murder. Karen turns to him abruptly and says, "They want to know if we're missing any rubber gloves, but I've already told them we aren't." Tom looks back at her, his heart lurching. He shakes his head. Time seems to slow down.
"Rubber gloves? No, we're not missing anything like that," he says.
He feels lightheaded and can taste the bile rising in his throat. He turns to the detective.
"Why?"
Tom knows he's a terrible actor. The detective with the sharp eyes seems to see right through him. The detective knows he's lying.
"We found a pair of pink rubber dishwashing gloves near the murder scene,"
Rasbach adds, "with a flowered pattern up near the elbows." Tom hears this almost as if he's hearing it from a distance. He feels very detached. He frowns. Everything seems to be happening in slow motion.
"We never had any pink rubber gloves," he says.
He watches Karen turn away from him, back to the detective. Jesus. He's just lied to these detectives. What the hell is going on?
"It doesn't matter too much where the gloves came from, frankly, or whose they were," the detective says. "What's important is that the tire tracks on those gloves and near the scene of the murder match the tires of your wife's car, putting her near the murder scene shortly before she had her accident."
He turns to Karen and says,
"You were driving very fast, apparently."
The detective leans forward and adds,
"A little convenient, having amnesia."
"Don't insult me, detective," Karen says, and Tom stares at her in shock. He would never have believed she was capable of such sang-froid. It's as if he's looking at a stranger.
"Don't you want to know who was murdered?" Detective Rasbach asks.
He's toying with them.
"Or do you know already?" he adds, staring at Karen.
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Karen says, "and neither does my husband. So why don't you stop playing games and tell us?" Rasbach looks back at her, unruffled.
"A man was shot 3 times, twice in the face and once in the chest at close range, in a deserted restaurant on Hoffman Street. We know that your car was near the murder scene. We were rather hoping you could fill us in," he says.
Tom feels physically ill. He can't believe they're having this conversation in his own living room. He was sitting in this very spot just a few days ago when the police came to tell him that there'd been an accident. Given the circumstances of that accident, he hadn't believed the driver could be his wife. But it was. Now this. What is he to believe this time? "Who was he?" Karen asks. "The man who was murdered." She's very pale, Tom thinks, but her voice is steady. She's remarkably composed. It's almost as if he's watching someone else, an actor playing his wife.
"We don't know," the detective admits.
Then he reaches into an envelope and says,
"Would you like to see a picture?"
It's not really a question. Tom still feels like everything is happening in slow motion. The detective places a photograph on the coffee table and rotates it so that he and Karen are looking at it right side up. It's the distorted face of a man with bullet holes in his forehead and cheek. The dead man's eyes are open, expressing what looks like surprise. Tom instinctively recoils. The detective places a second photo beside the first. This one shows his bloated body with blood splattered all over the chest. The photos are revolting, disturbing. Tom can't help it. He glances at his wife. She is so still, she looks like she has stopped breathing. Then he quickly looks away. He can't bear to look at his own wife.
"Is that jogging any memories for you?" the detective asks her a little flippantly. "Do you recognize him?"
She stares at the photos, as if studying them, and slowly shakes her head. "No, not at all." The detective looks as though he doesn't believe her.
"How do you explain your car being near the scene?" he asks.
"I don't know." A note of desperation has finally crept into Karen's voice. "Maybe someone hijacked my car and made me wait there as a getaway driver," she says. "And maybe I managed to get away and that's why I was driving so fast." Detective Rasbach nods, as if he appreciates her creative efforts. Tom desperately thinks it's possible, isn't it? "What other evidence do you have?" Karen asks boldly.
"Ah," Detective Rasbach says, "that I'm not prepared to say."
He gathers up the photographs, glances at his partner, and starts to rise. Karen and Tom stand up. Rasbach takes a business card out of his suit pocket and offers it to Karen. She takes it from him, looks at it, then places it on the glass coffee table.
"Thank you for your time," the detective says,
and the two men leave, Karen shutting the door behind them. Tom, filled with dread, stands shell-shocked near the sofa. Karen comes back into the living room, and their eyes meet. Chapter 14. Rasbach reflects on the interview in the passenger seat of the car as Jennings drives them back to the station. Karen Krupp is hiding something. She was admirably self-possessed on the surface, but she was panicked underneath. He believes she was there, very close to the murder scene, presumably around the time of the murder. Although that's a pretty big presumption at this point, as their estimated time of death is necessarily broad. But he's convinced the timing of the two events is the same. What was she doing there? The husband is a lousy liar, Rasbach thinks, remembering his demeanor during the interview. He's certain the Krupps are missing a pair of pink rubber gloves. Someone must have seen Karen Krupp leaving the house that night. They need to know whether she was alone. Rasbach decides to return to Henry Park later that evening to talk to the neighbors. And they'll need all the Krupps' phone records, too. Maybe she got a call. They will look very thoroughly into Karen Krupp. He leans back in the passenger seat, rather pleased. The case has taken an interesting turn. He loves it when that happens. Tom, horrified, stares accusingly at his wife. He has just lied to the police for her, the woman he loves. What has she done? His heart twists painfully. "Tom," she says, and then stops, as if she can't think of what to say next, as if she can't possibly explain. He wonders if she really can't explain, or if she's faking it all. He believed her in the beginning, believed that she couldn't remember. But now he doesn't know. It certainly looks like she has something to hide.
"What the hell's going on, Karen?" Tom asks.
His voice sounds cold, but inside he's feeling desperate. "I don't know," she says fervently. Her eyes well up with tears. She's so convincing. He wants to be convinced, but he can't quite believe her.
I think you know more than you're letting on, he says.
She stands motionless in front of him, straight-backed, as if daring him to say what he really thinks. But he can't. He can't accuse her of murder? My God, what has she done?
You lied to the detectives, he says, about the gloves.
So did you, she says sharply. This shocks him. It's like a slap across the face. He hardly knows how to respond.
Then he says, in a fury,
I did it to protect you. I didn't know what else to do. I don't know what the hell's going on.
Exactly, she snaps back at him. She walks a few steps closer, never taking her eyes off his. They're within arm's reach of each other.
That's my point, she says, less confrontational now. I don't know what's going on either. I lied about the gloves because I didn't know what else to do. The same as you.
Tom stares back at her in dumb shock. Finally, he says, whether you remember it or not, those are probably your gloves, and we both know it.
At a murder scene. Why were you at a murder scene, Karen?
When she doesn't answer, he continues, appalled at what's happening.
They have evidence that you were at the scene of a horrible crime.
He can't believe that he's saying this to Karen, the woman he loves. He runs a frantic hand through his hair.
That detective obviously thinks you did it. He thinks you killed that man.
Did you? Did you shoot him?
I don't know, she cries, desperation in her voice.
That's the best I can do right now, Tom. I'm sorry. I know it isn't good enough. I don't know what happened. You must believe me.
He glares back at her, not knowing what to think. He feels life as he knows it slipping away from him.
She looks at him, her eyes steadily on his.
Do you really think I'm capable of killing someone? Do you really think I'm capable of murder?
No. He can't imagine her killing anyone. The idea is ridiculous, monstrous.
And yet, he's coming after you, Karen, Tom says, stricken.
You saw what he was like, that detective. He's going to dig and dig, and he won't quit until he gets to the bottom of this. It won't even matter that you can't remember. You won't have to. The police will find out what happened, and they'll tell us.
He's almost shouting now. He's trying to hurt her because he's scared, and he's angry, and he can't trust her anymore.
She's even more ashen now than when the detectives were here. If you don't believe me, Tom...
She leaves it there, hanging in the air, waiting for him to protest, to say that he believes her.
The silence drags on, but he doesn't say it.
Why don't you believe me? She asks finally.
What a question! He says roughly.
It's a valid question! She persists. She's angry now, too.
What have I ever done that would let you believe that I could kill someone in cold blood?
She steps closer. Tom watches her, but says nothing.
You know me! How can you think I'm even capable of something like murder? I don't know what happened that night any more than you do.
Now her face is up close, just below his. He can smell the faint perfume of her skin.
She presses. Whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty?
She's breathing rapidly, her face close to his.
You don't know what happened, so why can't you believe that I'm innocent in all this? Tell me, is that any more far-fetched, any more insane, that I shot someone and left him for dead?
Now she is almost shouting. Tom looks back at her, his heart tight. In all the time he's known her and loved her, he's never had even the slightest reason to doubt her about anything. It all comes down to that night. What really happened? Doesn't he owe her something for that complete trust? He shakes his head. In a lower voice, he says, "The police come in here, accusing you. You lie in front of them. I don't know, Karen." He pauses. "I love you, but I'm scared." "I know," she says. "I'm scared, too." Neither of them speaks for a moment. Then Karen says, "Maybe it's time to go back to Jack Calvin." That evening, Karen sits quietly in the living room, a magazine lying ignored on her lap. Tomorrow night will be exactly 1 week since her accident. A week, and she still can't remember anything. The afternoon had been terrifying. The police, that cold-blooded detective, had practically accused her of murder. And Tom. Tom seems to believe she might have done it. She's afraid of the police, afraid of what they might find out, afraid of what Dr. Fulton might tell them. She realizes that she's clenching her teeth and tries to relax. Her jaw aches. The photographs. Karen can't get the grisly images out of her mind. She thinks of Tom, upstairs in his office, closeted away with some work he brought home. Or is he just pretending, like her? Is he sitting at his desk, staring at the wall, unable to get the images of the dead man out of his mind, too? Probably. He looked sick when he saw the photos. And then after, he wouldn't even look at her. Now she glances out the front window and starts. She sees two men in suits at the door of a house across the street. Even in the near dark, she recognizes the two detectives again. With a feeling of encroaching horror, Karen walks over to the window, staying close to the wall. When she gets to the window, she stands behind the curtain, looking out. They're interviewing the neighbors. Of course. Chapter 15. Bridget looks out at the street. Darkness is falling. She spends a lot of time here with her knitting, watching what goes on outside her window. Bridget is a skillful and creative knitter. She's even had some of her own patterns published. She has a knitting blog that she's very proud of, where she showcases some of her work, and she has a lot of followers. On the banner across the top of her blog is written, "Knitting isn't just for old ladies." And there's a picture of Bridget there, too. Bridget's happy with the picture, which she had taken by a professional photographer. She's very attractive in that photo. She photographs well. She'd once tried to teach Karen how to knit, but Bridget could tell she wasn't really interested in learning, and she didn't have the patience for it. They'd had some laughs and agreed that maybe it wasn't Karen's thing. Karen seemed to want and enjoy Bridget's company anyway, despite their different interests. It's too bad Karen hadn't taken to knitting. Knitting with someone is a great way to get them talking, and Karen isn't one to open up easily. Earlier today, Bridget visited her favorite shop, Knit 1, Purl 2. She was running out of the fabulous purple Shibui yarn she'd bought last time. The minute she walked in the door and saw all the colorful skeins of yarn bundled along the walls, almost up to the ceiling, she felt her spirits lift. So much color, so much texture, such unlimited possibilities. She walked happily around the shop, admiring, feeling, and gathering up various yarns of different weights and colors until her arms were full. She loves gorging on yarn. Bridget was stroking a lovely orange merino wool when a woman she vaguely recognized approached her. "Bridget," the woman said, "I'm so glad to run into you. I wanted to tell you how much I loved your last blog post about fixing knitting mistakes." Bridget almost blushed with pleasure. "I missed an increase, and that trick with the crochet hook worked like a charm." "I'm so glad you found it helpful," Bridget said, smiling. It was gratifying to share her expertise and be appreciated. It made all the hard work of writing the blog worth it. Sandra, at the cash register, was also happy to see her.
Bridget, we don't see you much anymore.
You must come back to our knitting circle.
Bridget instinctively cast her eyes to the chairs arranged in a circle at the front of the store. She wasn't ready to come back. She couldn't face it. Too many women happily knitting baby things. At least three of the regulars were pregnant. And they talked about it constantly. She couldn't trust herself not to let her hurt and disappointment spill over. She couldn't trust herself not to say something unpleasant. None of them would understand. Better to keep away.
Soon, Bridget lied. I'm really busy with work these days.
She hadn't told anyone there that she'd quit her job because of the fertility treatments. She didn't want to tell them about her fertility issues. She didn't need their pity. She picked up the bulging, expensive bag of yarn and quickly left the shop, her mood spoiled. Now, Bridget watches as two men in suits come down the street, knocking on doors. The men stop at her neighbor's house. She'll be next. When she hears the doorbell, she puts her knitting aside and answers it. She's alone in the house. Bob is out at a function, as he so often is. The two men stand on her doorstep. The taller one, handsome with striking blue eyes, pulls out a badge and flips it open.
I'm Detective Rasbach, he says. This is Detective Jennings.
Bridget tenses.
Yes,
she says.
We're conducting a police investigation. Did you happen to see your neighbor, Karen Krupp, leave her house on the evening of August 13th? That's the night she had a car accident.
Pardon?
She says, although she heard him perfectly well.
Did you see Karen Krupp leaving her house on the evening of August 13th? She had a car accident that night.
Yes, I know about the accident, Bridget says. She's a friend of mine.
Did you see her leave the house that night? The detective presses.
Bridget shakes her head.
No.
Are you sure? You live right across the street. You didn't see her go out?
No, I didn't. I was out until later in the evening myself. Why?
She looks back and forth between the two detectives.
That's kind of a strange question.
We're wondering if she was alone.
I'm sorry. I have no idea, Bridget says politely.
Perhaps your husband was home that evening. Is he here? The detective queries.
No, he's not home. He's out most evenings. I think he was out that night, too.
The detective hands her a card and says, If your husband did happen to be home and saw anything, would you please have him give us a call? She watches the two detectives stride back down her walkway and go on to the next house. Neither Karen nor Tom can sleep, although each pretends for the other. Tom lies on his side with his face to the wall, his stomach churning. He keeps replaying the scene of the detectives in their living room that afternoon, over and over. He remembers the ease with which his wife lied to them about the gloves. In contrast, he had lied badly, and they all knew it. He feels Karen move restlessly on the other side of the bed. Finally, she gets up quietly and creeps out of the room. He's used to this now, her getting up in the middle of the night. Tonight, it's a relief. He hears the bedroom door close softly behind her and turns over and lies on his back, his eyes wide open. Tom had seen the police detectives going up and down the street earlier that evening from the upstairs office window. Karen must have noticed them. Yet neither of them had mentioned it to the other. He feels sick when he thinks about the police investigating her. Hates himself for the creeping doubt he feels about her. Now he's watching her all the time. Wondering about her. About what she's done. And he can't help worrying. What will the police find?
Chapter 16
Karen has Tom drive her to Jack Calvin's office on his way to work the next morning. Luckily, Calvin was able to fit her in. Tom has an important meeting that he cannot miss and cannot stay. Or so he says. Karen wonders if maybe he can't deal with any more of this, or doesn't want to. Or perhaps he thinks she'll be more forthcoming with the lawyer if he's not there. But she's not going to tell the lawyer any more than she's told her husband. She just wants to know what she should do. Tom leans over and kisses her on the cheek when he drops her off, but he doesn't meet her eyes. She tells him she'll take a cab home. She stands in the parking lot for a moment, watching her husband drive away. Then she turns and walks toward the building. Once inside, she hesitates for a moment in front of the elevators, but then she presses the button. When she arrives at the lawyer's office, she swallows her fear, opens the door, and walks in. She has a longer wait this time, and her nerves begin to get the better of her. When she's finally ushered in to see Jack Calvin, she can feel the tension in her shoulders, her neck. "You're back," the lawyer says cheerfully. "So soon. Does this mean you've remembered something?" He smiles at her. She doesn't return his smile. She sits down. "What can I help you with?" Calvin says now, all business. "I still don't remember anything about that night," Karen tells him. She imagines what he must think. He probably thinks she's here to tell him something she couldn't tell him in front of her husband, about some sordid affair she's conducting on the rough side of town. She will have to disappoint him. "Tom has a meeting this morning that he can't miss," she says. He nods politely. "Everything I tell you is protected by attorney-client privilege, correct?" Karen asks, looking him directly in the eye.
"Yes."
She swallows and says, "The police paid me a visit yesterday."
"Okay."
"I thought it was about the accident."
"It wasn't?"
"No." She pauses. "They're investigating a murder." The lawyer's eyebrows go up, his eyes sharpen. He takes a fresh pad of lined yellow paper from his desk drawer, grabs an expensive-looking pen off his blotter, and says calmly,
"You'd better tell me everything."
"It was horrible." She chokes on the last word. She feels nauseated, remembering the photographs of the corpse. She can feel her hands trembling in her lap and squeezes them together. "They showed us photographs of the body." She quickly tells him about the detective's visit. "I didn't recognize the dead man," she says. She watches the lawyer closely, hoping he will somehow be able to save her.
"You were speeding, running red lights, not far from where a murder took place. Possibly around the time the murder occurred," Calvin says. "I can see why they might want to talk to you."
He leans forward, his chair squeaking at the movement. "But is there anything else to tie you to that crime?
Because unless there's something else, that's nothing to worry about. That's a dicey area. It has nothing to do with you, does it?"
She feels herself swallow again. She looks at him, steadies herself, and tells him the rest. "They found some gloves." He stares at her with his sharp eyes, waiting.
"Go on," he says.
She takes a deep breath and says, "They found some rubber gloves in a parking lot near the murder." She hesitates, then adds, "I'm pretty sure they're mine." The lawyer stares at her. "Our rubber gloves are missing." She pauses. "I don't know what happened to them. They're quite distinctive. Pink, with a flowered pattern near the top."
"Did you tell them you were missing some gloves?" Calvin asks.
She can tell from his tone how incredibly dumb he thinks that would be. "I'm not that stupid," she says tartly.
"Good. That's good," he says, obviously relieved.
"Tom lied for me," she says. She can feel her mask of composure slipping.
He told them we weren't missing any rubber gloves. But they could tell he was lying.
Rule of thumb, the lawyer says. Don't lie to the police. Don't say anything. Better yet, call me.
She says, they said they don't need to prove those gloves were mine. Because apparently my car ran over them in that parking lot. They have tire track evidence. So they can put me, or my car, at least, near the murder scene. They have evidence.
Calvin looks back at her, his face grave. Who's the detective on this, anyway? Who figured that out?
His name is Detective Rasbach, Karen says.
Rasbach, Calvin says, looking thoughtful.
I don't know what to do, Karen says in a low voice. They were all over my street last night, the detectives, talking to the neighbors.
The lawyer leans forward intently and fixes his eyes on hers. You do nothing. You don't talk to them. If they want to talk to you, you call me.
He takes another one of his business cards, turns it over, and writes a number on the back.
Use this number if you can't get me at the others. You'll always be able to get me at this one.
She takes the card from him, gratefully. Do you think they have enough to charge me? She asks anxiously.
Not from what you've told me. You were in a parking lot, near a building where a murder was committed, possibly around the time of the murder. You were speeding and had an accident. You might have seen something, that's all. The question is, what else will they find?
I don't know, she says nervously. I still can't remember anything about that night.
Calvin takes a minute and scribbles some notes. Finally, he looks up at her and says, I hate to mention this, but I'll need a bigger retainer, just in case.
Just in case. Just in case she's charged with murder, Karen thinks. She fumbles in her purse for her checkbook.
I have to ask, Calvin says quietly. Why might you have had a pair of rubber gloves with you?
She deliberately avoids his gaze, searching in her purse for her checkbook. She says, I have no idea.
Chapter 17 Rasbach runs a thorough background check on Karen Krupp. If you don't count the recent high-speed accident, she's a model citizen. Not a single moving violation on her driver's license, not even a parking ticket. A fairly solid employment record, temping and then 2 years at Cruikshank Funeral Homes as a part-time bookkeeper. Her taxes are in order, no criminal record. A nice, quiet, suburban Upper New York State housewife. But then he digs a little deeper. He knows her maiden name is Karen Fairfield. He knows her date and place of birth. Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He starts with some basic searches. But he doesn't find much on Karen Fairfield from Wisconsin. No record of her ever having graduated or even attended either grade school there or high school. She has a birth certificate and a social security number, a New York driver's license. But other than that, prior to a couple of years ago, there's nothing on Karen Fairfield with the date of birth he's been given. It's as if she rose, fully formed, at the age of 30, when she moved to New York State. Rasbach sits back in his chair. He's seen this before. It's not as rare as the average person might think. People disappear all the time, and take up life elsewhere under new identities. Karen Fairfield is obviously a fiction. She's a segue into a new life. Tom Krupp's wife isn't who she says she is. So who is she? He is going to find out. It's only a matter of time. He drops by Jennings's desk to share what he's learned. Jennings lets out a low whistle.
I've got something, too, Jennings says. She got a call.
He hands a printout of the Krupp's phone records to Rasbach.
Rasbach takes the printout from the other detective and looks over the information carefully.
She got a call at 8:17 p.m. on August 13th, the night of the accident, Rasbach notes, looking up at Jennings. From an untraceable cell, Jennings says. A burner phone. He adds, obviously frustrated, we don't know who called her or from where.
You don't use an untraceable cell phone without a good reason,
Rasbach says, pursing his lips. What the hell was she up to, this housewife of ours? He murmurs. He's not surprised to learn that she received a call right before she tore out of her house that night. He expected as much. Because the night before, they'd found two witnesses who had seen her leave. One, a mother of three who lived diagonally across the street from the Krupps, had seen Karen Krupp run down the front steps and get into her car, obviously in a hurry. She said Karen had been alone. Another neighbor farther down the street remembered her because she felt that Karen had been driving too fast when there were kids playing. She, too, was certain that Karen had been alone in the car. Rasbach says, feeling a familiar excitement, she gets a call at 8:17, runs out of the house in the middle of making supper, doesn't lock the door, and doesn't take her purse or her cell. Jennings says, the call was to the landline rather than to her cell. Her husband was very late getting home from work that night. The call could have been meant for either one of them. Maybe they're both involved. Rasbach nods thoughtfully.
We'd better take a closer look at Tom Krupp, too.
Karen Krupp leaves the lawyer's building and steps outside into the hot sun. Now that she's alone again, not having to pretend for either her husband or her lawyer, what she feels is blind panic. She has just given a lawyer a very large retainer in case she's charged with murder. She's terrified. What should she do? Her instinct is to run. She knows how to disappear. But it's different this time. She doesn't want to leave Tom. She loves him, even if she's not so sure about his feelings for her anymore. Tom is finally back in his own office after an unbearably long morning meeting. He closes his office door and sits down in the chair behind his desk. He's finding it impossible to focus on work. He's falling behind with everything. He's grateful that he has an office with a door that closes, one that doesn't have walls made of glass. Otherwise, everyone would see how little work he's doing, how much time he spends pacing the floor and staring out his window. Almost immediately, his cell phone buzzes. He snatches it up and looks at the caller ID. Bridget. Shit. Why the hell would Bridget be calling him?
Bridget, what's up?
Is this a good time? Bridget asks.
Not an emergency, then, Tom thinks. He starts to relax a little.
As good as any. What is it?
There's something I need to tell you, Bridget says.
Something in her voice warns him that he isn't going to like it. Instantly, he feels himself tense.
What?
I wanted to tell you this before, she says, but Karen's accident just kind of pushed everything else out of my mind.
He wishes she would get to the point.
The police were here last night, asking questions.
Tom feels the perspiration start to bloom on his skin. He closes his eyes. He doesn't want to hear what she has to say, whatever it is. He wants to hang up.
Bridget says, I didn't tell the detectives this, but I think you should know. The day that Karen had her accident, there was a strange man looking around your house.
What do you mean, looking around? Tom asks sharply.
This guy. He was looking in your windows and snooping around the back. I was pulling weeds on the front lawn, and I kept an eye on him. I was almost ready to call the police, but then he came over and talked to me and said he was an old friend.
Of mine?
Tom can't imagine who it could be.
No, of Karen's.
Tom feels an escalating dread. His heart is beating loudly in his ears.
Did he give a name?
No. He just said he knew her from another life, Bridget says, emphasizing the words. Tom says nothing, startled. I don't want to freak you out, Tom, and you know how close Karen and I are, Bridget continues in a concerned voice. But that's kind of a strange comment, don't you think?
From another life.
What did he look like? Tom manages to ask.
Medium height and build, I think. He was rather nice-looking. Dark hair. Well-dressed.
Dark hair. There's a long pause while Tom thinks, his mind racing.
Bridget finally says, You know, it's always seemed odd to me that Karen has never shared much about her past. At least not with me. Maybe she does with you?
When Tom remains silent, she adds cautiously,
I hate to suggest this. I know what you're going through with the accident and everything, but...
But what? Tom asks sharply.
What if there's something in her past that she's hiding from us?
Tom wants to hang up, but he can't move. What the hell do you mean?
This may sound crazy, but I saw a show on TV a little while ago about people who are running from their pasts. They disappear and take on a new identity. Maybe that's what she's done.
That's ridiculous, Tom protests.
Is it?
Bridget counters.
People do it all the time, apparently. There are people online that can help anyone do it for a fee.
Tom clutches the phone and listens with growing alarm.
They get a new ID, then drop out of sight, move somewhere else, start over, change their appearance. They become perfect citizens. They don't want to be pulled over. They don't want to be noticed.
Tom remembers, with dawning horror, how law-abiding Karen is, or was, until the night of the accident. What if Bridget's right, and his wife is using a fake identity? Why would she do something like that?
Tom? I'm sorry. Maybe I shouldn't have said anything. It's because of that damn TV show. It just crossed my mind when that man was asking about her.
He thought nothing could throw him after the events of the last week but this. The suggestion that his wife may be someone else? It's more than he can handle.
Bridget, I have to go, Tom says abruptly.
He gets up from his chair and starts to pace, trying to process this terrible new possibility. A man with dark hair was at their house that morning. A man who said he knew Karen from another life. What if Bridget is right? And Karen isn't who she says she is? The police will find out. That terrible photograph. The dead man had dark hair. Tom feels sick to his stomach remembering. Maybe he's just being paranoid. Or maybe he's starting to see things as they really are. Chapter 18. When Tom arrives home that evening, he carries within him a bubbling stew of negative feelings. Anger, distrust, fear, heartbreak. He knows she can tell that something has changed, but he's not about to tell her about Bridget's call. What's wrong? Karen says at last, after an almost silent meal.
That's kind of a silly question, given the circumstances, Tom says coldly. Maybe I don't like living with the fear of the police showing up on my doorstep to arrest my wife.
He hadn't meant to say it. It just slipped out. He watches her face go white. He wants to blame her, tell her that everything is her fault. But instead, he just turns away from her.
You haven't asked about my appointment with the lawyer this morning, she says, equally chilly. He hasn't forgotten about it. He just would prefer not to know. How did it go? He asks, dreading what she might say.
I had to pay him a bigger retainer.
Tom gives a bitter laugh.
Why am I not surprised?
Would you rather I not have paid him? She asks sharply.
How far their marriage has deteriorated in just a week, Tom thinks.